This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If someone tells you they're a science teacher, think about that. That really doesn't narrow it down a whole lot. There's earth science, chemistry, biology, astronomy, physics. These are all taught by science teachers. But it takes a special person to teach ocean science when there isn't an ocean for hundreds of miles.
Even though, Arkansas isn't touching the ocean anywhere, it still affects us.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear the story of an ocean science teacher in a landlocked state. Then we'll stay with science and head into the clinical lab, where different labs are returning different results on the same samples. And really, nothing good can come of that. And then it's an academic minute about the attack of the killer sponges, because that's just a fun thing to say. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Mary Cook describes her home state like this.
We have lots of rice fields. It's also the world headquarters for duck hunting, international headquarters for Walmart. We're number one in chicken production. I think we're the only state in the union that has a diamond mine.
You may have guessed by now, Mary Cook lives in Arkansas. She teaches 7th and 8th grade science at Alf Junior High School in Searcy, Arkansas, which is about an hour and a half away from Little Rock.
Arkansas used to be called the land of opportunity. Because of all these opportunities, the chickens, the rice, the diamonds, but I think it's still the land of opportunity.
Mary's students think so too. Ari Daniel from the Ocean Gazing podcast has the story of Mary Cook on ocean science teaching in a landlocked state.
How did someone like you from Arkansas get engaged in ocean science?
Okay. I've been teaching earth science for about 25 years. I've always found it difficult to teach my students, who are most of them are around 13 years old, about the ocean because most of them have not been to the ocean. And so I've always been looking for ways to make it more personable.
Mary Cook came across a program called Teacher at Sea. It's run by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it gives teachers, from kindergarten teachers all the way to college-level teachers, the chance to board a NOAA research cruise and work side-by-side with scientists and crew to learn about and help do the science. Cook read through the different cruises that were available.
There was one particular voyage that was going to be looking at climate and climate change and gathering data and deploying buoys on tsunamis, and those are things that I teach. And so I just thought, okay, I'll apply for it. Maybe they'll pick me, maybe they won't.
They did pick her, and just like that, Cook's dream gave way to the reality of getting ready to go to sea for 3 weeks far off the coast of Chile. The chief scientist for the cruise was going to be Bob Weller, a physical oceanographer from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Cook got her principal's approval to participate. She found a substitute teacher, but all this turned out to be the easy part.
Before I left, I was really, really worried. I knew I would love the science. I mean, that I didn't worry about that. I was worried that I would be on that ship and want to get off. I would begin to view it kind of like a prison. But I'm kind of a person that if I'm afraid of something, then I'm just going to go ahead and make myself go through with it because I want to conquer that. But it didn't take long after I was on the ship and we were out to sea to realize that I never, ever felt like it was a prison at all. When you can't see any land for 3 weeks, it's kind of a liberating to just look at sky and water.
And every day, Cook wrote a blog with stories and pictures for her students. She told them about how the science team was studying the Earth's climate by using buoys and drifters and probes to measure the ocean and the atmosphere. Her students emailed her back, and Cook was sure to let them know when the buoy they'd adopted as a class was released into the ocean to track the temperature and pressure of a particular current. It was this buoy, more than anything else, that caused her students' interest to skyrocket.
They signed these stickers, and then I took the stickers with me, and when I got to the ship and to the little buoy, I put all of their stickers on. Then I took pictures, and I posted them on the internet. The interest in ocean currents, quadrupled among my students because of that. And so they knew You know, that was their adopted buoy.
I was reading this, your reflections on your Teacher at Sea experience. And at one point you say that even though the Teacher at Sea cruise took place a few years ago, it continues to be the potent force in my approach to teaching my students about oceanic and atmospheric sciences today. And I just wondering why.
Because it's so personal. And I think if you can make it more personal for the teacher and the students, they're going to remember it. I've talked to those students that I had 5 years ago, and one of them, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about his graduation night, that he wore his NOAA pin on his graduation gown. So to me, it made a great impact on them. It's so personal to me, and I learned so much. I mean, I had read about research, but now I know about it, and I've participated in it.
At Alf Junior High, Cook's current students agree. Brett Blasco is one. He's in the eighth grade. Before moving to Arkansas, he grew up on the ocean in Washington State.
I enjoy the ocean, in the summer, because my dad lives in California, so we go to the ocean, swim.
So does the fact that Miss Cook kind of went on this trip and was one of the first teachers ever to kind of go out to sea, does that make her kind of extra cool?
Yeah, I think it helps because it shows that she's been there and she knows what it's like, and it's more interesting to look at and get more into.
Emily Rollins is also in the eighth grade. She's from Searcy, Arkansas, but Rollins has gotten to see the ocean on vacation in Mexico. Studying the ocean is her favorite part of science class.
Yeah.
Why do you say it's your favorite subject?
Because I've always liked, you know, being near water and around the ocean. I think it's very interesting how, you know, the ocean affects our climate.
Do you actually see that in Arkansas?
Yes. Because, you know, when Louisiana has its hurricane season, we kind of get the sort of the aftermath, what was left over from that up here. But mostly it comes in real heavy rains or tornadoes. Even though, you know, Arkansas isn't touching the ocean anywhere, it still affects us.
You think you want to do something with the oceans in the future?
Well, the thing I would like to learn to do with the oceans, like learn about the marine life that lives there. And I thought that would be a good job option for the future.
So if you could have one wish about the ocean, what would it be?
If I could constantly live there forever, because I love being there. It's kind of like being surrounded by a whole different world.
The beauty of the Teacher at Sea program is it lets the students in a classroom touch that different world, help them feel connected to the ocean in a way that's lasting and meaningful. The program's been around since 1990, and more than 500 teachers from across the country have participated. If Mary Cook's experience is any indication, it can really lead to a sea change in how teachers and students alike relate to the ocean.
Right, because it opened a lot of doors in that respect for me. And so now when I'm looking for lessons, it means something to me when I see it. And I can also turn around and explain that to my students.
Now that you've been on the sea and you've actually gotten to know the ocean in a very intimate way, I'm wondering if you can kind of, you know, describe what your relationship is with the ocean, you know, like personally.
Some of my impressions of the ocean was how big it was. I mean, I was just overwhelmed at its depth. Something I do remember is thinking that the ocean felt like it was breathing because it has this constant kind of swaying or moving. That's kind of a comforting feeling. Instead of being afraid, I felt more comforted by it.
And that story from Ari Daniel was part of the special Ocean Gazing podcast series. It's produced by COSINEL with support from the National Science Foundation. For more information, go to oceangazing.org. Still to come, order the same meal from two different restaurants, and sure, you expect differences. But order blood work from two different labs, that should bring the same results. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The laboratory is becoming just as important as the doctor's office when it comes to diagnosing diseases and other conditions. A nurse takes your blood or other stuff and sends it off to the lab. But sometimes one lab might not agree with another. Consistent and comparable results from different measurement procedures are important for developing clinical practice guidelines and for those guidelines to be applied to decisions about patient care. Yet results for many analytes are neither consistent nor comparable when measured using different clinical laboratory procedures. Last year, in the July 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, experts in harmonization of test results offered their opinions on the current state of the art in laboratory medicine and how things could be improved. The moderator for that panel was Dr. Greg Miller. He's a professor in the Department of Pathology and Director of Clinical Chemistry at Virginia Commonwealth University. We spoke about this last year, and I asked Dr. Miller to basically explain just what harmonization means in the context of lab results.
Well, harmonization refers to the condition when a patient's sample would have the same value if it were measured by all of the different methods that are in use for a particular analyte. A closely related term is standardization, which means that harmonization is achieved by having the calibration of all of the different methods traceable to a common reference measurement procedure. These two terms are frequently used interchangeably because they both mean that results are comparable among different measurement procedures. Harmonization is considered a more general term that includes standardization when the process is based on a reference measurement procedure.
So why is it important to have lab results that are harmonized when measured by different methods?
Well, clinical practice guidelines are commonly used and frequently base therapeutic decisions on fixed laboratory values. So if different methods give different results for the same sample, then we have errors in treatment of patients that are possible. Clinical guidelines are frequently developed based on results using a single method in a central lab, but the problem occurs when these guidelines get into general use. They become less effective if different methods give different results. And physicians are generally not aware that different lab methods can give different values, so the clinical laboratory community has a responsibility to ensure that results are consistent and can be compared irrespective of the method used. This is why having clinical laboratory experts as members of guideline development groups needs to be encouraged, so the measurement factors are considered when a guideline is developed.
It seems like harmonization of lab results is a basic requirement. Why are there differences in results when measured by different methods?
Well, there are only a small number of analytes that actually have reference measurement procedures with well-characterized reference materials used for calibration. Many of the analytes we measure in the lab are complex biomolecules for which there is no reference procedure, and when there are reference materials, in many cases, they have not been developed to be commutable with clinical samples, which causes errors in calibration. And there are a lot of analytes that do not have any reference materials. So developers of procedures choose something available to use as a calibrator, but there's no uniformity in the materials chosen by different developers, so the results for patient samples are not harmonized. In addition, the actual molecule measured by different assays may not be the same, or it may not even be understood which molecular form of a biomarker is most important for its use in diagnosing or monitoring a clinical condition. Because of this, different methods give different results for what they think is the same molecule. A classic example is troponin I, which is a multi-protein complex whose composition changes in the course of a heart attack.
You mentioned commutability as an important property of reference materials. Can you expand on just what that is and why that's important?
Sure. Commutability is a property of a reference material. That means it has reactivity characteristics that are the same as those for the biomolecule being measured in a clinical sample. Historically, the importance of commutability was not well appreciated, and so we have a number of so-called reference materials being used as calibrators that are actually not commutable with patient samples. Fortunately, the importance of commutability is now generally recognized, and developers of reference materials are now paying attention to commutability as an essential property to ensure the reference materials are suitable for use as common calibrators in a calibration traceability process.
Doctor, what tools are available for in vitro diagnostics companies to harmonize results from their measurement procedures?
There are several ISO standards that describe calibration traceability and what is required. And when a complete reference system is available, this includes a reference measurement procedure and a primary reference material for calibration, then manufacturers can fairly easily establish calibration to that reference system. However, the calibration traceability must be maintained for many lots of reagents, different lots of product calibrators, and different instrument platforms. These differences in details in implementation and how carefully a clinical laboratory uses a routine procedure will influence the consistency of results. The situation becomes more complex when only a reference material is available for calibration. Because of the commutability limitations we discussed, issues with complexity of the biomarker, and limitations in the specificity of a routine method. Consequently, there's more variability among different routine methods when there is not a reliable reference measurement procedure.
Many laboratories develop their own measurement procedures, usually called laboratory-developed tests, or LDTs. How can LDTs achieve harmonized results?
The issues regarding calibration traceability for LDTs are essentially the same as we've just been discussing. The main difference is that there are very few internationally recognized reference materials to use as common calibrators for the analytes measured using LDTs. As a result of that, different labs will use different calibrator preparations, and there's no consistency among them, so it's much more challenging to achieve harmonized results.
Are there regulations to consider in achieving harmonized results?
Yes. In many countries, there are regulations that clinical diagnostic tests must meet to be used for patient care. A major stimulus for harmonization came with the EU directive in 1998 that required any IVD products sold in Europe to have calibration traceable to higher-order reference systems when these were available. So for lab tests entering the market, regulators are increasingly requiring conformance to any harmonization schemes that are generally accepted by the lab medicine community. One of the challenges for harmonization is the cost to resubmit for regulatory approval to change the calibration traceability for an existing routine assay so that it will conform to any new national or international recommendations for harmonization. The cost is amplified for a multinational IVD manufacturer because the regulations are not uniform in different jurisdictions. So in many cases, the adjustment of calibration is really a simple linear factor and the other characteristics of the assay remain the same. In this case, a relatively simple process for regulatory review should be suitable. In other cases, more extensive changes in the assay are required, so there is not a one-size-fits-all approach for regulatory review. In any event, a collaboration with regulatory bodies is an important part of our efforts to improve harmonization of laboratory results.
Well, finally, Doctor, can you just summarize what the clinical laboratory community is doing to improve harmonization of test results?
Yes. In today's world, it's very important to recognize that harmonization activities occur on an international level, so we avoid national or regional differences in the agreement of results. The scientific division of the IFCC has for many years promoted standardization projects for a number of analytes, with considerable improvement in results harmonization. In fact, a lot of the reference measurement procedures we currently have available have been directly or indirectly stimulated by the work of the IFCC. But one of the big challenges has been a lack of an oversight body to prioritize the analytes that need to be harmonized and to coordinate the work of different organizations in different parts of the world that contribute to achieving harmonization for different analytes. So to address this situation, the AACC organized a conference in 2010 to identify and address the needs for harmonization. Based on the conference recommendations, the AACC has initiated formation of a new international consortium for harmonization of clinical laboratory results. This consortium is now operational and has as its primary goals to prioritize analytes in need of harmonization based on their clinical impact and their use in guidelines, to provide a web portal to coordinate the work of different organizations to prevent duplication of effort and to promote harmonization processes, in particular for situations when there is not likely to be a reference measurement procedure developed. Additional information on this program is available at the website harmonization.net.
Dr. Greg Miller is a professor in the Department of Pathology and Director of Clinical Chemistry at Virginia Commonwealth University. Harmony, I need a pretty good company. Dream of never, never, never leaving harmony. Never leaving harmony. 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 Harmony.
It's the attack of the killer sponges. I really just wanted to say that, but that is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can't tropical plants just get along? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Joseph Pollack, professor of biology and marine biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, explains how some sponges are threatening the health of coral reefs.
The health of coral reefs around the world has declined over the past three decades, but corals are particularly threatened on Caribbean reefs, where the combined effects of warming seawater temperatures, storms, and diseases have decimated these slow-growing creatures. The critical importance of coral reefs for both shoreline protection and fishery habitat has led the United States government to list some reef-building corals under the Endangered Species Act. At the same time that corals have been in decline on Caribbean reefs, populations of sponges have been doing very well. For reef-building corals, sponges do not make good neighbors. Aggressive competitors for space, sponges use toxins, mucus, shading, and smothering to kill adjacent coral colonies and then grow on their skeletons. We surveyed reefs from 12 countries across the Caribbean, comparing 25 sites where fish abundance is very low because of decades of intensive fish trapping, with 44 sites where fishes are plentiful because they are protected from fishing. Over 25% of coral colonies at overfished sites were in contact with sponges, more than double the incidence for less fished reefs. On less fished reefs, fast-growing sponge species were eaten by angelfishes and parrotfishes, leaving only slow-growing sponge species that are protected from these predators by distasteful chemical defenses. Coral conservation requires a healthy population of reef fishes. Caribbean nations can now base their fishing policy decisions on the clear connection between overfishing and sponge-smothered corals. These nations include the United States, which has over 1 million acres of coral reefs in the Florida Keys, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and the Gulf of Mexico.
That was Joseph Pollack of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with Mount Holyoke College.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.